All right. So, Miss Stephanie Hepburn is here in the studio. Hang on, let me turn your mic on. There we go.
Can you hear me?
Hello. I can hear you. Can you hear you?
Yeah.
All right, awesome. So, I haven't forgotten all of my engineering skills after having been away for a couple of days. So, yeah, Stephanie, thank you so much, first of all, for coming in and spending the morning with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and just for listeners, let us know how you came to live in New Orleans and why you're interested in human trafficking.
Okay, so I moved to New Orleans in February 2006, and as you all know, that wasn't long after Hurricane Katrina. And I was living in New York at the time, and my husband's a native of New Orleans. So after Katrina, he said he needed to come home, and I said, okay. He said, no, I want you to come with me. I was, okay. So.
It's always love.
That's
love.
It's so
a beautiful story.
Mm-hmm. So then I moved here, and it was, I think, that my second day after moving all of my boxes in, my husband took me on a tour of New Orleans. I'd been to New Orleans before, but not post-Katrina. Mm-hmm. So we drove by City Park, and I'd been in City Park previously, and I already had an image of what it was. And what I saw was a tent city, so tent after tent after tent, and there were people living in it, in that area, in the tents. And some were residents, it looked like, and some looked like migrant workers, but these were terrible conditions. Mm-hmm. And it made me wonder, with the quick rebuilding of New Orleans, what was happening with the laborers? Were they being paid well? What was happening with the residents? When you have that much unsettling, it makes people vulnerable. And there are unscrupulous people who come in and step in and take advantage of that situation. So I just started digging and talking to attorneys. And it turns out that there was a lot of human trafficking that happened in the few years right after the storm, in part because of the rebuilding, because it was a sudden demand for low-cost labor. So I started digging into individual cases, and it looked, you know, many of them followed the same exact pattern, which is companies would recruit, the recruiters would be in different countries and bring in workers on legal visas, but then charge recruitment fees and not pay them. And so they ended up in indentured servitude, mm-hmm. And they would withhold their documentation. So that was the impetus for me to research human trafficking. And then I expanded to other states and to other countries. So in total, in my first book, I look at 24 different nations.
So did you have an interest in human trafficking before you moved to New Orleans? Or what were you doing before you moved here? Like, what did you anticipate your career would be when you began your life?
So at the time, when I was in New York, I was working for compliance on Wall Street, for a bank on Wall Street. And at the same
compliance
time...
Compliance is the bank?
No, compliance would be the area. It was in Deutsche Bank.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
And, but I was also writing a book on women's roles and statuses around the world. Mm-hmm. And so I also looked at 26 countries and did comparative in terms of how women are paid and healthcare, marginalization, just where women stand, because all of my peers kept saying, well, I'm not a feminist, but I, you know, of course, believe in equality. And I'm like, well, you know, feminism means equality. That's what that means. Right. But they're like, well, I think we're fine. And I'm like, okay. So that was the impetus. So I decided I wouldn't put any narrative into it. It was purely going to be empirical data and law.
Right.
And it says what it says, you know.
Yeah. And just for listeners, I've read an article that you'd written in the Huffington Post last year regarding your experience with your realization about how women are perceived as being, as bringing violence onto themselves. Can you talk a little bit about when you first realized that this was happening and what your reaction was?
So it was interesting because sometimes it just seems like all of these little elements around you influence your decisions. And when I wrote that article, a friend of mine had come to me and said, Stephanie, you have to look at this. This is a 3-page dress code. She's an attorney in the city. And she's like, just, I'm not even going to talk about it. Just look at it. Just read it. So I read it. And only 4 bullet points applied to men. Everything else applied to women.
Wow. Right.
And it was just
shocking. Was there anything about baggy pants in there or sagging pants in there?
For men? No.
See?
No, it was purely, you know, you're responsible, you're, you know, autonomous. Just dress the way you should dress.
Sure, sure, sure.
But the regulation of women and the, you know, the policing of women is totally different.
Right.
And so, you know, the dress code, it was so ridiculous that it was humorous in the language. Mm-hmm. But it was sad that, you know, you have this highly educated woman working in a professional world and they're still trying to police how she dresses. And it's not, you know, and as she said, it's not like she or her colleagues are going to court or going to work dressed inappropriately. So it's purely, in my opinion, something that we as a culture inherently do from generation to generation to generation. And I don't think that whoever wrote this document realized, and whoever approved the document, because that's really the question, who approved it.
It's coming from a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Whoever approved it certainly was a lawyer.
Right. Think you've got to think that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it shows that there's just such pronounced cultural bias that it's not a conscious thing. That's, you know, we, even if you're trying to be aware of it, are probably constantly making slip-ups that are influenced by how we were raised.
Right.
So in looking at this 3-page document, it addressed how a bra should fit, how your underwear line should not show, how you should be wearing heels. It was just extremely sexist.
Right. And the implications being that a woman that does not conform to these sorts of expectations or rules would be attracting violence onto her.
Correct. Or in this case, it would be unprofessional. So for that atmosphere, it wouldn't be a violence issue. But what I made a comparison with was the earlier years and this mindset that we have. It was during a time period where a lot of dress codes were getting attention. And, you know, you look at these dress codes and they're incredibly archaic. And some of them either directly or allude to somehow or in enforcement and implementation create a situation where women are taught, or young girls are taught, you're responsible how you dress. You're responsible for how people treat you.
Right.
And if somebody mistreats you, they're not responsible for mistreating you or abusing you. Mm-hmm. You are, by how you dressed.
And it's a powerful article. And so I encourage people to go on the Huffington Post, and you can just look up Stephanie Hepburn, and you can check out her work there. But we digressed a little bit from the human trafficking. So I want to get back to that. So, and Stephanie's written a children's book, and
yeah,
she's going to be reading from it for us today.
Yeah.
And so I just want to take a little break. I'm going to have to read a couple of announcements, and then we'll have you read some from your book. All right. WTUL New Orleans, Stephanie Hepburn is here in the studio with us. She's written 2 books on human trafficking. The first one was, Stephanie, why don't you describe the first one in terms of, you mentioned that it's kind of a dry read as opposed to the second one you've written. Why don't you explain the difference, and then we'll have you read from your children's book.
So I think the children's book is really tailored to both adults and children. It's more, how do you speak to your children about this topic? And it doesn't go into what may not be age appropriate. You can read this to a 5-year-old. You can read it to a 15-year-old and add in whatever you want to add. But the reason I wrote it is because I wanted to give people the bare bones and a quick explanation. And frankly, we don't know everything about everything. And because this is my area, it's a really easy way for me to break down and for people to understand, okay, these are the signs, these are the indicators, without having to do ample research. They can look at this and it can be a quick guide for them to talk about a very sensitive issue, in my opinion, a pretty easy way for both them to understand and for them to explain to their children. So the book functions, I mean, it has colorful graphics. It's designed for a child to be able to, or a young adult, to be able to read themselves, but also it educates parents, and they might want to read it to their child or first read it themselves and then read it to their child. The other book, it's much more of an academic endeavor, and that this one, the second one, is more geared towards a mainstream audience. But the other book is more geared towards somebody who knows just a little bit about human trafficking, or is particularly curious about the topic and what that means in the United States, and what that means elsewhere. And you know, the gist is it happens no matter what. In both books, the realization that it happens no matter where you are, it's happening, and that no area, no city is exempt from it. And so I think that that's the biggest message of both. There's some commonality there. But yeah, one is short and the other one's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages.
It's the Wikipedia of the human sex trafficking, right. A la Stephanie Hepburn. Well, and also people tend to think of human trafficking as in terms of sex workers being trafficked across the globe. But labor is also, and you mentioned when you came to New Orleans and saw the tents in City Park and these corporations that were exploiting workers for low wages and basically trafficking them to and from across borders without any real issue. I know that when George Bush was the president, you know, importing immigrants from other countries to come to New Orleans to work for $2 an hour was not an issue. It's only an issue now that the city's been largely rebuilt, and they don't want to, you know, if they could continue to pay them $2 an hour, I think it wouldn't have a problem with them staying. But they, you know, they don't want to pay them minimum wages or living wages. And so now there's this big thing that we only all got to go now. Thanks for rebuilding our city, but now you got to go. So I know that you've pointed this out in many of the articles and publications that you've written, and I think it's really, really interesting. And also, we're going to have you read, but I also would like you to comment on, if you would, about the attitude that, you know, these migrant workers are coming to our country to take jobs away from Americans, and I mean, the reason that migrant workers come here in the first place, you know, and if you can, I don't, what role the United States and other developed nations play in pushing workers, low-income workers and farmers and so on that have lived in rural communities all their lives in other countries, push them to come to the United States. So, but really interested in your children's book, and I think that it's a very difficult subject, I would think, to broach with your children. And I love the idea of parents reading the book to their children and educating themselves as they're reading as well. So yeah, if you would read something for us now.
Well, just to answer your question really quickly in terms of migrant workers, I think it's a multi-layer process where there's lack of enforcement at each step of the way. So part of it is that companies took advantage that certain visas were under-monitored or just completely unmonitored. And so there are, built into those visas, there's a checklist, and you're supposed to indicate as an employer that you cannot find labor locally. But because there was unmonitoring and under-monitoring, employers were lying about that. So it's enforcement that is really, we have laws, but it's whether they're enforced and how they're implemented that's important.
Can you name some of the larger corporations that were participating in this kind of activity right after Katrina, the construction?
And not get sued. You can read my book for that information. We'll stick to not getting sued today.
Fair enough.
Okay, so the book is called Conversation with My Daughter About Human Trafficking, and it is exactly that. It's a conversation that I had with my daughter walking home from school one day, and she is, you know, obviously heard, you know, these peripheral conversations while I'm on the phone or seen me on TV talking about this. But this was the first time that she showed interest in knowing more. You know, she's like, oh yeah, you write about human trafficking. But this was the first time that she wanted to ask me about it. And I have to admit, even though I know a lot about the subject matter, it made me nervous to explain this to a 7-year-old, because it is such a difficult topic. And I wanted to inform her but not create fear. And that is a very difficult balance for a seven-year-old and for me as an adult to try to explain this to her. Ironically, it ended up being an easier conversation with her than many adults because she's very open, as children are, to admitting what they don't know. As adults, it's a bigger struggle because we don't like to admit what we don't know. So it takes, you know, an hour longer to figure out what the gaps are.
I don't know about you, but I know everything.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read this to you. Okay, so the other day, my daughter asked me some questions about human trafficking, which has been the focal point of my career over the past decade. I want to share her questions, thoughts, and my replies because they quickly get at the root of people's common misunderstandings about human trafficking. I hope our conversation helps you to talk to your little or big ones about this important topic. As we take turns pushing her one-year-old brother in his stroller, my daughter asks me why people don't just stay away from bad people, then they won't be trafficked. I tell her that usually the story starts out with hope. In fact, sometimes it starts off like a fairy tale, and the person can't believe his luck. The trafficker may tell the person that she knows of a job where the person can make lots of money and help his family. Many times the person's family is having a hard time. Maybe the person's mom died or is sick, and the person wants to help, needs to help somehow. This job solves the problem, and finally the person thinks it will all be okay. Sometimes the person gets to go on a plane to a brand new city or country. This seems exciting, but once he gets there, what seems like a dream quickly turns into a nightmare. My daughter asks me why the person couldn't tell the trafficker was mean. I tell her that while traffickers are bad people that control, lie to, hurt, and scare other people and force them to work without getting paid, they don't usually look like bad people. A lot of the time they look kind and act really nice at first. This is hard for her to understand because in her mind, if a person is mean on the inside, they should look mean too. But that just isn't the case. My daughter says, oh, so they can look nice and be mean, just like the lady in Annie. She means Miss Hannigan in the remake of Annie played by Cameron Diaz. I tell her, yes, they don't have to look mean to be mean. My daughter responds by saying, and just because a person acts nice, that doesn't mean they aren't tricking you to do something bad to you. Exactly, I said. She asks me what traffickers do exactly. When she thinks of traffic, she thinks of cars, bikes, and traffic signs, not people hurting people. I tell her that traffickers are people that make men, women, and children work day and night without pay. This makes them tired and sick. They are forced to do all kinds of work, like make the clothing that we wear every day, pick fruit, make bricks, and ask for money. The traffickers make people live in places that aren't clean or safe, and they don't give them much food, sometimes just mashed vegetables or moldy bread, so they are often hungry. They also don't take them to the doctor if they get sick. My daughter responds by asking why the people who have been trafficked don't leave. If they can find a window and open it, can't they run away? She asks. I tell her the traffickers threaten to hurt the people if they try, and often the traffickers do hurt them. Not just for trying to escape, but just because the traffickers want to and can. This makes the people scared. They are scared the traffickers will hurt them again, and scared they will hurt them, or worse, if they try to run away. My daughter asks where traffickers go to find people to traffic. It seems unreal to her and must be happening far away. She can't imagine it happening anywhere near where we live. I tell her the way trafficking happens is really similar, no matter where it takes place, regardless if it's where we live or across the world. We want to believe that trafficking can't happen where we live, but it can, and it does, because it happens everywhere. Traffickers go to the same places we do, I tell her. They go to where there are a lot of people, like malls, schools, buses, and train stations. They use Facebook and other internet sites to try to meet the people they will hurt. They can use classmates at school to recruit and find people to traffic. My daughter is little, and this seems unreal, but it happens, and we need to talk about it. She asks me what to look out for and what to tell her friends. I tell her to beware of strangers. Stranger danger isn't new to her, but it's a new way to look at it. I tell her to know the clues and to tell an adult she trusts, a teacher or me, if she notices them. What are the clues? She asks. Kids who are trafficked may miss a lot of school days, and they may have bruises or be scared. They may be hungry, tired, have tantrums or outbursts, or their clothes may not make sense, meaning they may wear summer clothes when it's cold. There may be an older person that hangs around the child but isn't a family member and seems to tell her, him, what to do. Sometimes one clue alone doesn't tell us much. I tell her that she doesn't have to know for sure. If you think something is wrong, even if it isn't trafficking, it's good to tell your teacher, I say. My daughter asks, but what if she's wrong? What if nothing is going on? I don't want to be a tattletale, she says. I tell her that telling her teacher that she is worried about a friend or classmate is kind. It isn't tattling. It gets confusing, I know, but I tell her to veer on the safe side and to tell the teacher she's worried. She can always tell me, too. Parents and teachers are busy, and sometimes we don't see what you see, I tell her. Trust your instincts and share. It could save someone's life. If you suspect human trafficking, call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, toll-free hotline, 1-888-373-7888.
Wow, that's a wonderful, wonderful piece of literature that you've written. And
thank
so
you.
Educational. That's the first time I've heard it, by the way. And so many thoughts are going through my head as you read it, and just what trafficking means, why a person would succumb to these kinds of promises that are being made by potential employers. And by the way, I did say earlier in this interview, I mentioned migrant workers, and this is a little bit different. This is not people just coming across the border to look for a better life. This is people who are actually being promised things by employers and coerced through incentives.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So when you were here and when you first came to New Orleans and you came into contact with some, you know, these people in City Park who were brought here, did you meet any of them? Like, what were their circumstances?
No, so I didn't. That was actually, so it's interesting because going to City Park was the impetus for me to research human trafficking. And at that point, I didn't know it was human trafficking. I just had a red flag, a gut instinct that something was wrong. And it wasn't until after my book was published that I, after talking to person after person about my book and this particular visual and experience that I had in City Park, that finally somebody was like, oh, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Nobody else knew what I was talking about. And they said, yeah, I remember that. And they did affirm that it was residents and migrant workers, and that anytime they wanted to use the bathroom, they were charged $5. But obviously, there, you know, aside from the bathroom, there wasn't running water, you know. And the first big case that I researched when I moved here was about Thai workers that came to New Orleans. Actually, they came on an agricultural visa to North Carolina and were taken from North Carolina to New Orleans to do demolition. And they were charged ridiculous fees in order to come, in order to secure the job. And so I think people immediately think, well, how in the world is somebody who is desperate to look for a job going to pay an $11,000 per person fee? You know, and so it automatically, many people will just dismiss that. That sounds unreal. But I think what people aren't considering is how they come up with those $11,000. The trafficker or the recruiter at that moment will push the person towards a loan shark, and the loan shark will give them the $11,000 with an astronomical interest rate. So that's the glue. That's the connector there. So it's not that individuals have this money just sitting around, but they may sell whatever land they own. They may have their family members may do the same. They may sell heirlooms. They're going to do whatever they can to make that fee. And also, you know, they're told, oh, okay, by the recruiter, by the trafficker, you know, don't worry about it. We'll pay the fee. You just work it off. But they never can work it off is
right.
The problem.
No, indentured servitude.
Indentured servitude,
and I think
yeah.
People, many people are familiar with that whole process through different kind of loan debt that they experience with the payday lenders here,
right.
The student loans. That's a little different, but still people get caught in this cycle of, you know, really not being able to meet their financial responsibilities, which begins a downward spiral and ultimately can impact their health. It can impact their mental health and so many other factors that really just downgrade society as a whole.
The difference, yeah, I agree with you. The difference is in this case, you know, for instance, the Thai workers, there was an armed guard that would prevent them from leaving.
Mm-hmm.
They not only were not getting paid, but they were instructed that they had to pay for food. So in the end, they ended up living and doing demolition in the same building, So as they were demolishing a building, that's also where they were staying. They had no food because they didn't have money, of course, because they weren't paying.
Impacts, correct. Right? I mean, all the asbestos and
that's exactly
mold
right.
and dust and chemicals that were found after Katrina. I mean, really, the city was just a toxic. But
the image that really sticks with me is that particular group of trafficking victims, they ended up having to catch pigeons and cooking them in contaminated water because to eat, that's all that they had to eat.
And the employers didn't even provide them with food.
No.
Is this still happening in New Orleans? Or I mean, what?
I mean, I think that what is very interesting about New Orleans and why it was such a great case study for me initially, not only being attached to the city and living here and seeing it, so my vantage point is probably different than somebody outside, but it was such a clear microcosm of what you see elsewhere that we in our heads are like, well, this is happening, this is a remote issue happening elsewhere, far, far away. But, you know, you look at the floods in India or you look at, civil strife in Colombia and that in our heads, we can understand how exploitation results from that. But we had a natural disaster here, and that destroyed the infrastructure temporarily. And then you have to look, okay, that's the same formula. It's the same formula that happens in India, in Colombia, elsewhere, happened here. And I think that is not only a good microcosm to explain it, but it's also an indicator to us when we hear it to realize, okay, we are not exempt from this. And we can't dismiss it. The more remote we feel something is, the less time we're going to dedicate to it and less awareness we're going to pay attention to it.
So. Right. And that fits in completely with Naomi Klein's thesis about the shock doctrine, disaster capitalism, and that wherever you find a disaster, you find these pariah corporations and multinational corporations that prey upon the disaster in order to basically make as much money as they can make with as low overhead as possible. And they get away with it because it's a disaster. So like you said, I mean, what is required really is more oversight, more accountability.
Yeah.
Exactly. But when we're hit with the shock, you know, the last thing that we're looking at is transparency and accountability and the things
Correct.
That we would normally be looking at in a functioning society. What we're doing is running to the epicenter of the crisis to
Surviving.
Just make sure people mm-hmm. are, that we're trying to save people, you know, make sure that they have food, water, clothes on their back, that they're healthy, that their medical needs are being met and that sort of thing. And
And community was destroyed. So their community is very important. It's our eyes and ears. And when that's been destroyed, you don't notice what's different because everything is different.
Yeah. Well, and I know I had this similar experience when, I came to New Orleans really to participate in the music and the culture and so on as an audio engineer. And then it was only after Katrina, and I had studied a lot about international relations and foreign policy and, you know, different kinds of corruption that was happening in corrupt governments around the world. And it wasn't until I got back after the disaster that when the covers got pulled off New Orleans that I began to see that all of that stuff I was studying and looking at and fighting for and fighting against in other countries and in other states and in other cities was happening right under my nose. And I hadn't seen it because I didn't come to New Orleans to do justice advocacy work. I came to New Orleans to be an audio engineer and dive into the culture and so on. But it was after Katrina that I got into justice advocacy work because my community were suffering. My friends were suffering. People I know had died and there was no record of their death. And I just, you know, so I couldn't not do something about it. And
once you know, you can't
unknow. You can't unknow, right. And so, and I keep doing what I do because the city's not recovered yet. You know, I came here to help the city recover. And now I'm working largely in the area of mental illness, mental health, trying to restore services that were lost. I mean, this is 10 years later, and we still don't have enough beds for people. We still don't have infrastructure in place that we need to help people get better. So I don't, you know, I keep saying, well, I'll go back to audio engineering once the city's recovered. But, you know, I just don't think that that's ever going to happen.
I think that once you It's also awareness. Now that you have that awareness, you're going to see deficits and you're going to see what needs to be fixed. So I think even when there's improvement, you may still feel that that's your purpose.
Absolutely. So I also would like to hear from you about what's happening. What can people do? I mean, in terms of advocacy work, I mean, this kind of situation is really outrageous. I think some people that are listening today may be outraged. What can people do?
Well, so I think that there's some everyday decisions that we can make. I think what's hard when I've done presentations and I've talked to people about it, it's hard because people don't do well feeling hopeless. And you hear something like this and you feel hopeless. You feel like you can't do anything about it. And that adds to the sense of remoteness. Well, I can't really do anything about it. So you push it aside. The good thing about this is that you actually can make everyday decisions that are beneficial. So how you purchase your clothing, where is it made? How is it made? Fashion is an area where there is rampant exploitation and human trafficking. So that's a good, not just your clothing, but any item that you purchase. There's going to be more transparency with brands that make it their mission. So look out for, it doesn't have to be fair trade, because fair trade just really means one aspect of production. But if you can find sustainable, look for words like sustainable, ethical fashion. Look not only about sustainability, to me, isn't just of the planets, of people and communities and culture. And look out for their mission if these companies definitely want to create transparency. Because in the fashion industry, one of the big problems is we have very convoluted supply chains, right? And it's the same thing that happens with workers, what we were talking about with companies. Some of those companies are overtly making decisions or overtly turning a blind eye, which makes them responsible. But you also have to look, no matter what the industry is, how convoluted is the supply chain? Is that company hiring workers, or are they hiring someone who hires someone who hires someone who hires workers? And the more convoluted the supply chain is, the more that you have a problem with lack of transparency. So look for, when you make your purchases, when you make your decisions, whether it's hiring a company, is it a local company? Is it somebody who hires individuals locally? How are those workers treated? And it sounds complex, but it's not. I mean, the people who care about these issues, they will be able to answer your questions in 2 seconds. If they don't know, you will know that they don't know. So I think that they're just everyday decisions that we can make with our purchases. You can vote with your dollar just by making, you know, ethical decisions in terms of where you put your money. In terms of awareness on the street, the other day, a good friend of mine contacted me. She's an Uber driver, and she contacted me and she said, I don't know if this was human trafficking, but something was weird. I can't tell you, you know, these are all the details that I have. I don't have a full answer, but just gut instinct, the ride that I gave to somebody, I feel like they were being exploited. And what do I do? You know, and I gave her, I contacted Polaris and I got her on the phone, the Polaris Project, which is our national hotline for human trafficking. So when I got her on the phone, she gave all of the details, and then it's their job to run with it, you know, or to pass it on to the local authorities. So, you know, you could call the Polaris Project or you can reach out to me. I'm fine with that.
How do people reach out to you and tell listeners about Good Cross?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So you can reach out to me. You can email me at STEP, like the word step, my last name Hepburn, HEPBURN, @gmail.com. And if you see something that you're concerned about, the good thing about this topic is that you don't have to be sure. So don't put that pressure on yourself that somehow you have to know. People need to follow their instincts, and it's sometimes your brain and instincts conflict. If you feel something is wrong, you give it to somebody else and they will look into it. You don't have to run with it. In fact, it's dangerous to run with it yourself. Don't become a PI, please. Please. Because that doesn't help yourself. That puts you in a precarious position. And if a trafficker notices, they're gonna yank that victim and move them somewhere else. So it's just detrimental all around. Good Cloth. So that the impetus for me to start this clothing store, it's an ethical fashion clothing store. It's online. It's at shopgoodcloth.com. So SHOP and then Good Cloth, GOODCLOTH.com. And writing the book was the impetus for it. I just wanted to create a space where people didn't have to do all that research themselves. For each item, I can include a product journey, so people know from beginning to end the history on each item. And I do it by different ethics. So that's the bar for every item that is put on the store. It has to be ethical to workers. So workers have to be treated fairly, if not better than fair. You know, fair is a kind of a strange term, but they need to be treated well. And a lot of these companies, they take it way beyond that. I mean, there's health insurance. There's cutting out the middleman who always, you know, tries to take a cut, you know, whether it's a middleman between the farmer and the mill, you know. So these fantastic NGOs that work with designers. So they go way above and beyond. And then also ethical towards the planet, because it's interesting to me, but people for some reason don't see the impact on the planet having an impact on people. You know, I think the best example I can give is, you know, there's this group that has been testing accessories, fake leather accessories. And I've written about it for The Guardian, and they test, fake leather bags or fake leather shoes, fake leather belts. And I believe it's 1 out of 5, they find lead in these items that we're purchasing and we're wearing. And certainly the level is not probably high enough to be toxic, but it's just an awareness. You know, when corners are cut, corners are cut. Mm-hmm. And it's not just this distant concept of the planet and some sort of deterioration of the planet as an abstract concept. You know, effluent and the flow from effluent affects people nearby, the food that they grow. Right. And, you know, you start seeing an increase in illness and cancers. So it affects people, and people need to understand sustainability is this, to me, this concept that's the planet and humans and our society and culture. It's all included. And so, yeah, the bar for good cloth is to make sure that I look at every single aspect of how, from beginning to end, of how a product is made in regard to those areas.
Right. Well, that's thank you so much for your work. And it's a really good, I think it's a really good message to people as to why they need to be aware of their environment, why they need to be informed, why they need to be involved, why they need to ask questions, you know, and to not just take things for granted. And, you know, what you're being sold is what, you know, that the message is actually consistent with the product. So, you know, we always at WTUL New Orleans, we try to give voice to the voiceless and represent the oppressed. But really want to encourage people also to get involved in whatever your issue is, in order to make for a more resilient and healthy society. So thank you so much, Stephanie, for coming in today. And we're going to, we'll podcast this and have it up on the Tumblr and Facebook as well. So if people want to re-listen, they can go to our Tumblr page and Facebook. And hopefully we'll have you back again one of these days.
We'd love it.
Yeah, well, I'd love it too. So thank you so much.